everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2025, and you're listening to episode 441, which is a conversation about end-of-life decisions and DNRs. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., which is an organization founded to equip Christians and pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an exclusive online feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Exploring DNR Decisions with Hope, and you can read it for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Jay, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
It is so great to be back.
Well, today, as I mentioned, Jay and I are going to cover the topic of DNRs, and that's something that's an acronym for a health directive. And this is a really important conversation, actually, for people of all ages. I think sometimes we think of some of these medical types of forms that we have to fill out for people who are elderly, but these things come up even for young folks. And if something serious happens to them, then their family is left to like, what do we do? So why don't you explain for our listeners, what does DNR stand for and what is it?
It stands for do not resuscitate. So a DNR is a medical directive, and there's different levels of making it available. You can either have that medical directive shared with your family, so everyone in your family knows what your wishes are. You can have it shared with your family and your doctor. You can have it put officially into your medical records so that as they pull it up in your medical records in a hospital, it will show up. But a DNR is a do not resuscitate order, which means that if your heart stops or if you go into a pulmonary crisis and your breathing stops, then they are not to perform CPR. They are not to intubate. They are not to use a defibrillator. They are not to take any of the normal resuscitation efforts to try to save your life. And so this, as you mentioned, it's something we most often think of when we're thinking of people in the 70s, 80s, and 90s area, particularly people who are dealing with maybe comorbidities, a lot of different things that they're dealing with, health issues or pathologies that they're dealing with. But it is something that is vital, I think, for people to both learn about and understand better when we're discussing all of the what is done to you in order to attempt to resuscitate you in the event of either a cardiac or pulmonary crisis.
So why would someone want to or not want to sign a DNR? I think most medical professionals assume, here's the DNR, please sign it right now. We can just put it into your file.
Yes. It's interesting. I've in preparation for this, I did talk to a lot of different people. I talked to people, particularly older friends of mine and family members, and I would say, do you mind if I ask if you have a DNR? And most people, and I'm talking about people in their late 70s and early 80s, most of them either did not know, were not sure, or said no.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and interesting.
Most of them would have a DNR.
And they had more advanced medical directives about very specific things, like should they be faced with brain death, a persistent vegetative state, or anything like this. But this particular thing, they all said no. And when I asked, there was a defensiveness about it for them as well, because they said, are you that and that big a rush for me to no longer be here? It was interesting that when you read about also there, in most of the studies on this, when you find medical studies that have been done, official academic studies, they're older. They tend to be in the 90s when you're getting data on how doctors were talking to patients and how patients were understanding. But there has been a place where it's difficult for doctors to talk. And one of the funniest things I read in one of the articles was the person writing this academic article said, first of all, doctors just aren't great at talking to patients anyway. It's not their skill. So when you're talking about the actual medical practitioners, they're just not comfortable talking to patients. But they talked about particular phrasings or ways that you talk about do not resuscitate orders that lead to people to not being comfortable with it because they feel as if they're being asked, are you ready to die? Or are you ready to give up? Or do you just not want to fight for life anymore? And the doctors say things like some of the ways that they talked about it when you read the evaluations of their communications with their patients, that they would say things like, do you want us to do everything that we can? Would you prefer that we not drive to the they made it sound as if they were asking the patient if you would prefer I just not treat you and let you die. And so one of the problems that they have is effectively communicating what a DNR is. And also there is, yeah, I mean, there's just some hesitancy, right? Because people don't fully understand what it is that they're agreeing to by putting in a do not resuscitate order all of the time. And doctors aren't the best at communicating. And there's fears that if I have a DNR, they won't treat me. And I won't get the normal level of medical treatment that other people will get, or that I'm just giving up on being alive. So it was even talking to people about it. I noticed that myself as I reached out to people and I would say, do you have a DNR? There was some confusion. Some of them thought they did. Maybe they did. They didn't know for sure. Others said, no, I don't, but I have these other medical directives in place. And then their response was similar to what we talked about, why I said why people would or would not. Is that they realized at this point that they felt like they were being asked if they're ready to give up in some way or another. Even my own family, when we've talked about this in regards to some of our family members, I got a pushback from family members when I asked about it, and they would say, no, it's too early for that. It's way too early to start talking about DNRs. And I said, well, let me give you some information, right? Let's have an informed conversation about it. So I think at that point, what a DNR entails, what it is you're refusing, and what the relationship is with now your medical professionals as far as what they will and won't do to help you if you find yourself in crisis. I think all of that keeps people from being more comfortable with it. And at the end, I would say, statistically speaking, though, DNRs, when you look at what they are, start to make a lot of sense when you're talking about people who are older, medically fragile, and who have, or I said, mentioned comorbidities, a lot of different problems that they're dealing with at any given moment. Those people should have a frank and honest conversation with their doctor about what CPR and attempts to resuscitate are, what they do to the body, how successful they are, and whether or not it's a good idea for them to consider a DNR.
Well, I do want you to explain a little bit more about them, because you just mentioned that there is confusion around what a DNR does and what it's allowing or not allowing, particularly, I think, in light of issues like euthanasia, especially when we hear, okay, this person, maybe they're an older person, or maybe they're not, something happened. Do we, now they're on this respiratory machine now, do we turn that off? Is that part of the DNR? And all those kinds of things that people are like, I don't know what it is I'm exactly agreeing to. So help our listeners know how to differentiate these different issues.
Yeah, okay. That is a great point, because there is so much confusion when you're talking about end-of-life issues and the ethics of end-of-life issues and relationships with doctors. When we're talking about this, we're not talking about anything in the category of euthanasia or hastening death. This is not embracing death as a medical treatment or a means to avoid pain or any of the things related to illness. This is not the desire to die. This is not the hastening of death. This is the acceptance of death. And so the differentiation there, and I quote in the article that I wrote for you, some of the Catholic teaching, both the basic teaching from the Council of Bishops has a moral obligation to use ordinary proportionate means of preserving his or her own life, that we have that. They say we have a moral obligation to use ordinary or proportionate means of preserving life. But Pope John Paul II wrote an encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae. And in there, he talks about the difference between euthanasia, the intentionally seeking of death as a means of alleviating pain, and of foregoing excessive medical treatments, which is what we're talking about with the DNR. And one, we are using medical technology and science to bring death to us. It's not here for us yet, but we're bringing it to us. And the other, as we're reaching our natural death, we are foregoing excessive medical treatments. As he says, either because they are disproportionate to any expected results or because they impose an excessive burden on the patient and his family. And I think that clarification is helpful. That the idea of euthanasia and accepting death as a treatment is different than saying, my body is failing. And I opened up the article. This is one of the reasons I was very excited to talk about this, as much as you can be. This is a hard subject to read about and discuss because my own father, I had to put in place a DNR for my father at the end of his life. He was in and out of consciousness in the hospital. His body was showing signs of reaching its natural end. He was progressing towards a natural death. And there came a point where we had to have a conversation as his medical surrogate in the hospital with his medical professionals that said, if at this point his heart fails or his breathing stops, what do we do? And that's a difficult question. And I will be honest, until I was preparing this article, I have had moments since the 16, 17 years since my father died that I have questioned, should I have tried to allow him to continue on? But it was only in finding
death, though, by welcoming this in, as you describe it, is that a non-biblical thing to, it seems like to the, you know, just the layperson, that this would somehow hasten death?
No. And part of it is a better understanding of CPR. Right. And that's part of the issue that we're having here is that, and I was talking to my son about this recently, if you watch movies and television and you understand the world through what you see there, so many things that they show us are just lies. And a better understanding about what they physically would have done to my father to keep him alive had his heart stopped and we had not put in a DNR helped me to come to terms with the idea that I had made the best decision for him. Right? Because it isn't, at this point, you are dying. And the question then becomes, what do we do to someone who's dying to force them to prolong their life a little bit longer? And we're under no moral obligation as human beings or as Christians to live as long as medical science can drag our life out. As a matter of fact, for many people, this is exactly what they want to avoid. They don't want to become an artifact of the medical community that is requiring of them through invasive medical measures to keep their heart beating and their lungs breathing for as long as we possibly can, long after a natural death would have taken us more peacefully and allowed us to move on to the next part of life. For Christians, we have no fear. We have no fear of the next step. We are given ample scripture all the way through that it is a natural thing that we're coming to the end of ourselves. It is just the process that we go through. So I don't think it is hastening death as long as you come to terms with the idea, an actual informed understanding of what the medical procedures that they would do to you, the cost that they will take on your life, the effectiveness that they'll have, the probability that they're actually going to save you, and what would be the physical cost of that salvation as far as those terms or using those terms that way.
We have so many great topics coming up on the Postmodern Realities podcast, including DNRs and end-of-life decisions, lucid dreaming, and of course, the very hot Severance Season 2. And we will be talking about the meaning of severance with Melissa Kane Travis. We have also an evaluation of the theology and work of Peter Enns coming up. And this is going to be very helpful for parents. What do you do when your student is doubting their faith? We have some do's and don'ts for Christian parents when confronted with those questions from their children about doubting Christianity. There's a lot being said about the Gen Z generation, particularly women. And so why are women more prone to leave the Christian faith in that generation? We'll be having an in-depth look at those statistics. And of course, a lot of cultural apologetics coming up. It's been a while since we've covered some video gaming. We're going to talk about Buddhism and Assassin's Creed. We've got Andor coming up, the new season 2 of that Star Wars series. And of course, all the big blockbuster movies, Mission Impossible, Jurassic World, DC Superman, and the Fantastic Four. So you don't want to miss out on any of these. And please let all of your friends know through social media, just telling a friend about all this great stuff that's coming up, because we help you know how to answer the most popular things and issues in Christian apologetics and theology so that you can use that as a springboard to share the gospel, or that you can make sure that you know how to clearly communicate a Christian point of view on that particular ethical issue. So we hope you will stick with us, tell a friend about us, and also tell others about us. If you would do a big favor for us and partner with us and head on over to Apple Podcasts. It just takes a few minutes of your time. There's no cost except for your time to write a short review. Because the more people that write those reviews for us, the more people will find this content. And I know there's other people that are very interested in finding out how Christian apologetics would answer some of these theological questions or respond to some of the latest and hottest cultural trends. So we hope you are enjoying this conversation. If you haven't thought much about DNRs and why everyone needs one, and I will get back to my conversation now with Jay Watts.
Well, you were talking about just this idea of, you know, maybe people don't want to keep going on if they are naturally dying to be maybe perhaps artificially kept alive for any longer just because we have the medical science. And does that, because medical science does allow us to live much longer than we could have in the past, does that make it why people are hesitant to consider DNRs? What if in their mind they're like, I mean, they know their body's failing, but they're like, I want to be here as long as possible for my family.
Yeah, I think that we have been given, and I mentioned that just a second ago, we have been given a false idea about how effective resuscitation is, in the sense that if it worked like it did in a movie or television, your heart stops, somebody jumps on your chest and starts pressing, they may punch you in the chest, scream at you to wake up, they'll shock you, and you'll wake up. And we are given the impression that CPR works a lot, is highly effective, and that the cost, the physical cost related to CPR, is low. In reality, it's the other way around, in the sense that the physical cost for CPR in the body and intubation or anything that we do to keep you alive is actually very high. It's a very invasive technique that we only want to do if we absolutely have to. And the probability that they're going to work is very low. And the misunderstanding, the general public, and there's the polling data is a little old, but I think it's probably still reliable. The general, more than half the population in the United States, when they were questioned in this, said that they thought that CPR worked about 75% of the time, that you're going to have about a 75% success rate. The reality is that it works. It's the numbers are hard to get, but it seems to work somewhere between 7 to 14% of the time.
Wow, that's crazy. I would have assumed, and maybe it's because of television and movies, that it always works.
No. It about 350,000 people annually have heart attacks outside of the hospital. You have about a 90% fatality rate. And so I think that we have this sense that cardiac arrest is eminently treatable, that CPR works, and that there's a very low cost. In reality, it's very, now it does work. And what I mean by that is if you are in cardiac arrest outside of a hospital, the best chance you have to survive is for somebody to immediately apply CPR, but they have to do it correctly. Even there, that's one of the things you see in the American Heart Association and Red Cross data on this, or as far as their literature on this, because they attribute some of the low success rates that we see to CPR to people not doing it correctly. So CPR is something that has to be done in a very specific way. And if you do it as it's meant to be, and here's one of the things I was just talking to my son about this morning, is take a tennis ball, sit the tennis ball on the floor, put your hand on top of it, and compress it all the way down as flat as you can on the floor, and then all the way back up so that it recovers. That's about a 2-inch compression with your tennis ball. And then do that 100 times a minute. And you have to get that all the way down and all the way up, all the way down and all the way up. Well, now feel somebody's, like, feel if I feel and sit here and tap my sternum, and I realize that what I'm saying is to correctly perform CPR, I have to push my sternum in 2 inches down and then let it recover 2 inches back up. Well, my sternum and my rib cage were not meant to do that, but that's the only way to do CPR correctly. And why do you have to do it correctly? Well, because your heart is very efficient at moving blood through your body. But it turns out that CPR, if done correctly, as I just described, 2 inches in, back to full recovery, 100 times a minute, it's only going to be about 30% efficiency as far as moving blood through the heart is what your heart would do if it were beating normally. and about 10% with efficiency in moving blood to the brain. So now it makes more sense as to why this failure rate is high. Because you take somebody in cardiac arrest, and even the best thing that we can think of to do, short of having a defibrillator on site to try to recapture with a defibrillator a healthy rhythm, which is all a defibrillator does. It doesn't restart a stopped heart. It takes a heart in the middle of cardiac arrest that has lost its rhythm, and it restarts it in the sense that it gives it a better rhythm. It gives it a chance to catch that rhythm again and start efficiently moving blood through your body. So even at its best, it's about 30% efficient about moving blood through your heart, 10% efficient about moving blood through the brain. So it has but it's going to break your ribs. It's probably going to break your sternum. And there is, if it's a prolonged use of it, doing that correctly, 2 inches in, 2 inches back recovery, 2 inches in, 2 inches back recovery, there's probably it's going to lacerate your organs, internal organs, things like liver, things like that can happen. And then if you don't have that heartbeat restored early enough within this process, at your blood moving through the efficiency in your brain is about 10% what it would with your heart beating, you face permanent cognitive impairment because of oxygen loss to the brain.
That just sounds so serious. I mean, like you said, in the movies, we see it, then somebody comes back to life or whatever. Yeah. But it sounds like with such low percentages that more harm could be done. It could cause more serious injuries than we think about because we watch TV.
Yes. And that is why you have to have it. And again, television and movies just have given us such a false understanding about what this is. The medical professionals say this is a bridge. This is a bridge that if you want to get somebody from that moment of crisis to medical treatment, and that period of time can be shrunk down, then CPR will save lives. It has the ability to save lives. It does save lives. If it were done correctly, immediately, and if we had defibrillators on site, the American Heart Association says we may save more than 100,000 more lives a year than we're already saving through the practice of CPR. But the reality of it is, it's going to take a toll on your body. And now go talk to your 80-something-year-old relative and look at whether their body can handle and have a serious conversation with them. Because that's when some of the doctors who have been through this, I had an EMT directly contact me about this. And when he knew I was talking about this, sent me a private message where he said, it's hard because the failure rate is so high, but it's the only chance that we have to help people. So, you know, someone has about a 90% chance of dying, but you are required to get on top of them and to start doing this incredibly intensive procedure to try to save their lives, which most of the time doesn't work. The overwhelming majority of times it doesn't work. And when you're talking about people who are older, and that's where you say that idea of they don't understand what CPR is. And they think somebody is going to just hit them in the chest a few times, yell their name, wake up, don't you die on me, or something like we see in the movies. And they're going to come back to life, take a deep breath, and everything's going to be fine. The reality is that 90% of the time that somebody has a heart attack away from the hospital, they're going to die. CPR will help maybe get them to the hospital. But even if people have heart attacks in the hospital and receive CPR from the medical community in there, nurses and doctors trained to do it correctly, with all of the equipment around, the success rate is still something like 20 to 40%. And a third of the people who are going to survive to discharge are going to have permanent cognitive impairment from lack of blood flow to their brain of some level. So now I think it makes more sense to say, okay, you should have a serious, open, and frank conversation with your doctor about what the physical cost of CPR are, what the probability of success is, and now why somebody who is later in life facing their natural death, who may have multiple issues that they're dealing with, multiple different pathologies that they're fighting at any given moment, may want to seriously reflect on the idea of saying, if my heart stops and my breathing stops, is then dealing with a slightly prolonged life with a very low chance of success. But if I do live, I'm certainly going to have broken ribs, most likely going to have a broken sternum, possibly going to have lacerated organs, and run a 30% chance of having permanent cognitive impairment. So it's not to undermine the life-saving nature of CPR and what can be done with it, but it's just to recognize that the reality of what people face, and those numbers get far worse. When you're talking about somebody in their 80s or 90s, the success rate of CPR is down to something like 2%.
I don't think the average person even knows when they're signing the DNR or whatever, or I don't want to sign the DNR, even knows what you just explained there. I don't know that I was clear on it, especially with the statistics. So is there a time, though, if somebody is in distress, they've had like a stroke or cardiac event or something else that has, you know, landed them in this situation, would an ER doctor ever over, let's say they have, you know, a DNR? Or, you know, maybe they're younger. Is there a reason why, or is there a time that a medical professional could override a DNR, or are they like just totally airtight? No matter what happens, it can't be overridden.
There's two things. The American Medical Association, under their rule, their code of ethics, say that a DNR is airtight. Now that's written in their code of ethics. If a patient has expressed that it is their wish that there be no attempts to resuscitate them, then it should be airtight. That's it. You have to respect the patient's autonomy. They say even in the case where the doctor knows that it would be better to resuscitate or attempt to resuscitate the patient, they should respect the autonomy of the patient. That's not now we get into the reality of it. Yes, doctors and medical professionals ignore DNRs all the time for different reasons. Now, I don't want to say all the time, but there are reasons. There are papers that are written where doctors are saying...
Is that legal, though? Can they ignore the DNR legally?
No, not really. Now, they can not know the DNR was there, which is more likely not going to happen with an EMT, right? So they suggest if you have a DNR and you put a copy of it, and it's, I can't remember the color off the top of my head, but they come in specific colors, and you put it on your refrigerator. And EMTs are taught when they come into your house to look at the refrigerator for medical directives. So if you have a medical directive and a DNR, you should post it on your refrigerator. And so when an EMT comes into your house, if they need to give you care, you can put necklaces or bracelets on so that EMTs will check that if they encounter you elsewhere outside of your home. But more often than not with EMTs, they don't know, because they are taught to respond as fast as possible. Because we already said the lag time between response and help is the difference between any chance of survival and death. And so they're going to come in as fast as they can and try to give aid as fast as they can. And so it's sometimes for EMTs, they just miss it. They don't have the opportunity. They don't see it. They miss it. There are other times when doctors have said they've overridden DNRs when they are in the process of caring for you medically, and you may have an allergic, like let's say you're in a surgical procedure and you have an allergic reaction to some of the medicine that they're giving you. And so you go into pulmonary distress. Well, even if you have a DNR, those doctors say at that point they will override the DNR because they don't believe your DNR cover, or their argument is your DNR was covering the event of a natural death, not something that was caused by me under the course of treatment. Now, there are doctors, and I've referenced a couple of them in the article that I wrote, who say they suspect that also some of this overriding DNRs may, and this is uncharitable, but they say that these are medical doctors saying some of their colleagues are worried about bad statistics. And so they may be saving people who don't want to be saved because they don't want them dying on their table or under their care. And so that is uncharitable, but that is a charge that comes from one of the doctors that talks about this. But legally, it's battery. And that's decided in the Cruzon versus Missouri case, where it is explicitly stated by the Supreme Court that DNRs and that idea to forego medical treatment is as easy as saying to somebody, I don't want you touching me. And legally, now if you do touch me, it falls under battery. So it is, no, they are not under AMA, American Medical Association ethics, allowed to override DNRs. It's legally battery if they do so, but they do it. And they do it for various reasons, for various excuses that they offer. Sometimes they just don't think it was the right decision. Sometimes they say, like, this is iatrogenic, it happened while they were treating the patient, and they see it not as a natural stoppage of the heart or stopping breathing, or they just have rushed in and not known that we're talking about somebody with a DNR, but by the time they found out, they'd already done the treatment, or they're already in mid-treatment, so they don't want to stop now. So it is difficult, because it requires a clear expression and then the hopes that the medical professionals that you're dealing with are going to honor your request. And to not honor it is both a violation of the ethics of the American Medical Association and a violation of battery laws. But the reality is that there's very little stomach for lawsuits in this particular area. So there's just no financial benefit. No lawyer is going to be able to collect a lot on this particular thing. So you don't see people filing lawsuits. As a matter of fact, in a case that was brought up in the New York Times article on this particular issue, they said that a woman who went through this and did not want resuscitation attempts, was resuscitated when she had a pulmonary incident while she was in a recovery room, faced long-term issues as a result of it, psychological and physical issues, could no longer care for herself. Her body was just not what it was prior going into that, but she can't find a lawyer that's willing to take the lawsuit because there's just no money to be made.
So can you explain to our listeners, you briefly mentioned something about autonomy, like our personal autonomy in these issues. So explain that. And what does the law say about what is a patient's right to autonomy? And how does that really affect DNRs if you have or have not signed one?
Well, and this is where I told when those people would say to me, are you just ready for me to die? When I was having a conversation with them, I would respond, no. But I do really want you to have a conversation with your doctor, assuming you trust your doctor, a very frank and honest conversation about what treatment looks like when your heart stops, when your breathing stops, what the physical cost of that will be on you. And then you may need to make an informed decision for yourself whether that is something that you want to go through in order to prolong life in the face of, as I've already mentioned, the high rate of failure and the high cost physically of the procedure being done correctly. And once you have made that determination, we should respect the autonomy. And also other things fall into this, malfeasance, the idea of a doctor shouldn't be hurting their patient, right? I mean, that's one of the things, do no harm is the beginning of the Hippocratic Oath, right? And so they are to do no harm. It's the first oath that they make to their patient. They'll do no harm. And that's where Pope John Paul II and his Evangelium Vitae was saying, in the informed the consent of the patient, they have to have the best information they can have. And then they must make decisions about the medical treatment that they wish to get. And in order to override that, like say you were in a hospital, first of all, the patient gets to make the decision. If the patient's incapacitated and they don't have clearly stated medical directives written down, then the medical surrogate, which is usually a parent, a member of the family, steps in. And that's what I did for my father. If the medical surrogates and the doctors wildly disagree, the doctors can go to a medical ethics committee in the hospital and to try to override the personal wishes of it, but it would only be the most extreme cases imaginable where they could either one way or another, either lift a DNR or put in place a DNR, because it would have to be something so extreme that the medical ethics committee was willing to violate the autonomy of the patient as expressed by their medical surrogate, which is a powerful, powerful thing within a statement of medical issues. Flat out, once you determine what you want done to you, that or what you don't want done to you, they are supposed to respect that across the board. And so your autonomy and the principle of malfeasance of not hurting you unnecessarily, both of those things come into play when we're talking about DNRs. If a doctor realizes, and one of the articles that I quote, it talks about code blues. And the doctor talks about the psychological effect of treating patients, every patient, as if they were going to live through this, when you know that's just not the case. And you wished that there were clear directives and that they had expressed in their own words that this is not something they wanted for themselves. Because as that doctor and other medical professionals, as that EMT that contacted me that one time said, they know they're doing harm in some cases when they're offering resuscitation attempts on people who just have no hope of being resuscitated.
So help us navigate. You mentioned that you had like a medical power of attorney for your dad at the time. How do people like adult children navigate that? What if they're, you know, parent who you have that medical power of attorney says, you know what, I don't agree with the DNR. How do you as a Christian say, okay, is it unethical to have one? What does, you know, is it unbiblical? How do we help, you know, so there's not conflict, like, okay, you're my medical power of attorney, you know, the statistics, but the person themselves feels still unsure. How do we talk about these things even in the family as these, you know, so many families every day make these medical decisions?
Yeah, I called up my siblings and to talk to them about care for one of our parents one time and said, hey, we need to have a conversation about what mom wants at the time. What did dad want? We need to sit down, but it has to be an uncomfortable conversation. So first of all, we all need to sit down and have an uncomfortable conversation where we face certain realities. And I think that's the hardest thing to having dealt with this a few times now with family members who are getting older. There is the desire to want to tell people what they want to hear. And especially when the fiction has been portrayed for us so often in front of us in the shows that we consume, the movies and television shows that we consume, there is a sense that you want to give people hope without having a real conversation about it. And that's one of the things that I think I have learned through the years in studying end-of-life issues. We're talking about not just issues like euthanasia and DNR, but all of these, how we deal with a life that's coming to an end, is to be able to sit down and have two frank conversations. Number one of them is the idea that, you know, when you get to be in your 80s, you have now lived past the average person's lifespan. And now we realize that, look, we have to talk about the way we're going to handle your treatment going forward as if we understood that your body is less capable of handling things. And doctors are terrible at communicating this as well. I had to be the go-between for my family and doctors in several different places where we had people, my grandmother, my father, people in the hospital, my aunt who were in the hospital, who were dealing with medical issues. And my family wanted aggressive treatment. And the doctor didn't want to say, in no uncertain terms, their body won't survive treatment. It won't. If we start introducing these, every medical treatment that you and I take, even at this age of 54 or even my son at 22 or anybody, if you go through medical treatment, there is both the benefit and a cost, right? Every single one of you take pills, those pills have a benefit and they have a cost. And the cost is usually excessive. It puts your liver through excessive work to try to clear out those chemicals from your body. But everything that we do has a cost. Well, you reach a point, we reach a point in our medical treatment, and this isn't just age related, it could be related to other pathologies, but you reach a point in the treatment where the cost is too high. Your body simply cannot pay the cost any longer. And without having an honest conversation about what it looks like at that point, then to say, look, our body can't pay. And that's one of the reasons, and I didn't mention this earlier, there are medical professionals that want to stop calling them DNRs. And there's two other terms that they use. As a matter of fact, the American Medical Association actually has already moved over to do not attempt resuscitation because they want to get away from the idea of people believing resuscitation is an option available to them. And they want people to start to understand that resuscitation is a rare result of this sort of intervention. So they change it to do not attempt resuscitation. Other professionals that work in this area like the terms allow natural death, AND, to just allow people to have a natural death as opposed to interceding with an intervention that is going to be highly stressful and low probability of succeeding. And so being able to sit down with people and say, as Christians, for me, I start to talk to them about things that we know about what's coming. The comfort that we've been given about the idea of what the end means, you know, the idea that we're not to proceed, as Paul said, people, we're not to mourn as people who don't have hope. I mean, we're not to see death in the same way that those people who don't have hope see it. We're to see death differently. We're to see life differently. We're to understand all of it through a different lens than the world around us understands it. And so even though CPR and all of these things have life-saving qualities to them, there is a point where we have to ask questions about, okay, and borrowing from Paul, have I fought the good fight? Is my race over? Have I done what I'm supposed to do? Paul calls living Christ, right? He says, and Philippians 1:21 through 23, to live is Christ. So our life is the opportunity to spread grace and mercy in the lives of other people, just as Jesus did, to represent Jesus, to be an ambassador for Jesus and the world around you. But then he says right after that, to die is gain. To depart and to be with Christ is better by far. That we are on the verge of something beautiful. And even though medical science keeps progressing to a place where we can extend life this side of heaven further and further, that we have the ability to live longer and longer, that when those interventions become so intrusive that they're going to do more harm than good, and what exactly are they keeping the Christian from? Well, I'm a selfish human being in the sense that I love my family. And at this point in my life, if you said, Jay, the cost of being able to see your daughter tomorrow is that we're going to break your ribs, break your sternum, lacerate some of your organs, and you are never going to be physically the same person that you were before this happens to you, but you will get to see your son and your daughter and your wife, your daughters and your wife for many more years to come, I'll make that deal in a heartbeat, right? But if I get into that point at 80 something years old, where it's like there's a 95% chance that we're going to do all of this to you and you are not going to be here tomorrow. And I feel like at that point, I have seen so many beautiful things. In the article, I know I'm running on here. In the article, I mentioned the movie Cinderella, the live action remake in 2015, directed by Kenneth Branagh. And it's a beautiful moment in that movie. The king finds out he's dying and his son looks at him. And you can just see the desperation and it, like, there's something we got to do, but it, unspoken. And Derek Jacobi, playing the king, looks at his son and says, "It's the way of all flesh, boy." And just at that moment, he accepts that this is just the destiny of all of us. It is given to all of us to die once. We are going to die from this earth. But he lives long enough in the context of the story to see his son fall in love, to see him become a man and to stand on his own. And at the time that he's dying and he's laying in his bed, his son climbs in the bed. And it's one of the, to me, it is one of the most beautiful moments because it tells us something profound about dying. And I've talked to many people who have been through this with relatives recently over the last few years. There's something profound about accepting that moment when it's naturally there. When death has reached us and our time on this earth has reached its end, to take comfort in the idea that we were promised that this is the beginning of something new. This isn't the end of anything permanently. It's the beginning of higher relationships, deeper love, more lasting and enduring grace and mercy, things that we can't even comprehend on this side of things. And so if we have that hope, then Paul saying that we shouldn't mourn like people who don't have hope. We should mourn like people who understand that our race has been run. We have fought the good fight, and now it's time to go to where it is better by far to die as gain and to not fight. Now, it may be, you may be of the mindset that you say, Jay, I'm just going to fight for every last second I get. Do not go gentle into that good night. I'm going to rage against the dying of the light. And that's fine. And that's where you get into the autonomy of every particular individual. But for that person that realizes that my body's coming to an end, I knew a person whose mother had a very aggressive form of brain cancer. She tried to fight it once and it came back. And she just said, no more.
Well, I think some people might be getting uncomfortable and saying, you know, Jay, you are in pro-life
yes.
ministry. And I hear what you're saying. But to me, by signing this DNR, it seems like I'm giving up on what Christians would hold to as being pro-life, that I see that my life or the life of my family member is valuable.
Yeah, it's precious. All life is a gift and it has inestimable value, but all life does end. And I heard one time I said, there's no such thing as death with dignity. A doctor one time told me that. There's no such thing as death with dignity. All death is terrible. Okay. Well, and from a Christian, then there's some level to that as well, in the sense that death is a curse, and that is what Jesus came to lift from us. But to hold on to that concept of life as only understood this side of heaven, I think is the mistake I'm fighting against. Not that life isn't precious, and not that we shouldn't endure as long as we could and spread the grace and mercy as long as we can. But had I not given that DNR from my father, what exactly was I going to do to him at that moment? His body was failing. And he had, and I say this, I perhaps would have felt differently, except he woke up shortly before he died. He woke up days before he died. And he and I was in the hospital with him. My father was not a Christian. I talked to him about having been there and praying for him. And he seemed to indicate that he knew I was there. He knew I'd been there and praying for him. I said, I'm praying for you every day. I hope that doesn't bother you. And he indicated that it did not bother him. And then I said, well, now that you're awake, I'll leave you alone on that. And he said he didn't want me to leave him alone. He wanted me to keep praying. And so I prayed with my father. And while I was praying with him and praying over him that afternoon as he was laying with me, I said, would you like for me to pray for you to receive Christ for the repentance of your sins? And we talked about the gospel for a moment. And he indicated that he wished for that to happen. And so we prayed together at that moment. Now, maybe if I thought there was still work left for my father to do at that point, I would have fought to have one more moment so that I could preach the gospel to him, reach him for the grace and mercy of Christ. But as my father's body was just coming to the natural end of his life, and I knew the intrusive nature of what they were offering to do to provide, to make him live a little longer with a high failure rate. And as one of the doctors said, look, if I saved this patient, they were still going to have cancer. They were still going to be in heart cardiac failure. They were still going to have all of these problems that they dealt with prior to this. But she said, instead of me being on him, forcing him to go through this death that I was putting him through, where I was doing chest compressions and trying my hardest to make him live longer, this medical doctor said, I wish I could have just sat with him and held his hand. And I think that that's one of the things we've lost. And I saw this in euthanasia, as we talked about, and we talked about physician-assisted suicide when you study that area as well. And you see it in the writings of Ira Byock, who is one of the founders of the modern hospice movement. We have lost in our culture the idea that dying is a part of living. We've separated death with us. We have put it in hospitals. We have put it away from us so that we don't have to see it and it doesn't have to be a part of our lives. But that isn't a part of the common human experience. Death was closer to them. They saw it and they weren't afraid of it in the sense that it was more of a natural part of the human experience. It happened in their homes. The bodies rested in their homes. They cared for the bodies afterwards. They were there as relatives passed on. And now it's so separated from us, I think we don't deal with it very well. So this isn't Jay, a pro-life guy, saying, give up on life. Life isn't precious. This is Jay saying, all of us reach the end of our life this side of heaven, every single one of us. And we need to make decisions when we get there as to whether we want someone to violently attack our body. And the older we get or the sicker we are, with an exceedingly low expectation that this is going to work. And if it does work, I'm going to deal with whatever it was that led me to that moment of death. And now all of the injuries that I accrued during the treatment and this invasive measure to keep me alive. Or I can just die. And death is not the end. So it's not something we should be afraid of, I don't think. Even though it's mysterious and hard for us to understand, and I understand the fear of death, at the same time, we've been given so much scriptural comfort that this is the work side of things. And that there is a time where we can say, the work is done. Now let me go home. And I don't think that that's bad. Now, but if you do, this is where autonomy comes in. If you're of the point of view that you should say, no, no matter the cost, no matter the physical impact on my body, no matter what it does to me, no matter the low opportunity of success, I'm going to fight for every last breath I can possibly have on this earth. Then I say, good for you. Use your autonomy to have that kind of plan made up for you. But no one is required to endure those heroic measures to try to endure just a few more moments of their time here on this earth. I don't think we're morally required to do so. I do believe that that blanket Catholic statement that I mentioned earlier and the teachings of Pope John Paul II probably are right online. I think we have a moral obligation and duty to do what is necessary under normal circumstances to preserve our life. But I don't think that we are morally required to be heroic in our pursuit of more time on earth when we know that means more probably than not damage to our bodies and a very low probability of success. I think at that point, somebody in their 80s or 90s whose body is fragile, I know somebody who dislocated their jaw biting into a cookie. This is a person in their early 80s. They bit into a cookie and their jaw dislocated because their body just isn't capable of handling pressures that it was when they were younger. Now, if you read the things that I've read over the last couple of months in preparation to write this article, and you hear about the kind of physical force that's going to be applied to that woman's body if she gets CPR. What on earth is CPR going to do to that woman's body when biting into a cookie dislocated her jaw?
I'm sure most people aren't even thinking about this. I mean, as they've listened to this podcast, they're just surprised, you know, at the stats, I think. And most of us, it's hard to come to grips, like you said, with mortality.
Yes.
As we are so far removed from death and we don't see it, you know, it's not like it was 200 years ago where you actually see people die.
Yes.
Very few people, they might see one or two people die, but it's not a regular occurrence that you actually literally are there when the person passes. And so, you know, people are probably very hesitant. So how do they even start the process? How would they? And also, I guess they would want to know, what if my doctor's not a Christian? Would they try to push me towards a DNR? Because they think, well, you're old. So, and that's another question. You said, okay, these people are older, but isn't that something where people might be confused with euthanasia? Well, you know, you've lived a good life. You're in your 70s and 80s. So why not just not, you know, it's time to die or what not?
Yeah.
So how do people deal with this issue biblically?
And I understand how it sounds like that, because that is clearly how it sounded when people and I talked to each other. I would say to number one that, and I think this is vitally important on every aspect from the beginning of life to the end of life, we should do the very best that we can to have as our doctor someone we trust. Because if you don't, I mean, that's where that kind of stress comes in. I trust my doctor. I love my doctor. I think he's a great guy. I enjoy going in and talking to him. And when he tells me something is good for my health and I ask him, I will ask him pointed questions about the types of things or when we go over my health and he tells me this is good for you, then I trust him, right? Because he is the doctor and he is the doctor I've chosen to put myself under the care of. And I think that's a big deal. We have to make sure that we have medical professionals in our lives with whom we have a great deal of trust, because we're trusting everything to them. And it is not saying, well, you might as well die. Remember, and basically what's happening and what we're talking about in these situations, resuscitation is bringing people back from the brink of death, right? This isn't you went to the hospital, you found out that you had a tumor, and this is going to be a care process going to last months. This isn't, we found out that you had a bacterial infection and we're going to treat it and it's going to take days or weeks to get you back. This isn't a viral infection that we've got methods of treatment. This is essentially your body stopped working. You were dying. And now we are attempting to resuscitate you, to bring you back from the very brink of death. Death that came on through cardiac arrest or pulmonary distress for reasons that we don't know at the moment what started that, what happened, what triggered it. But this is the most extreme situations that we could talk about. That's why the treatment is so extreme, because this is a fight for life. This isn't just in the ordinary intervention of medicine. This isn't just ordinary medical treatment. This isn't just you were going to live a lot longer and then we withheld or gave you this to make you die, or we withheld artificial nutrition and hydration and you died over the course of weeks. Those are different moral concerns, different ethical concerns. They have to be discussed. But in the context of what we're discussing here, we're discussing an emergency situation where our life is ending and they're attempting to intervene and resuscitate us back to a normal place. And I think in every medical professional I read said, when you're talking about people where this is an isolated incident, their body's capable of handling the CPR, then CPR is the thing that you do. It's a life-saving thing. And more people should know how to do it. We should have more defibrillators out there. We should be more equipped to deal with these sorts of things when they happen, because it's the number one way that people are dying by far. But there comes a point where we recognize that the treatment itself is too violent. As I mentioned, that person, and I just shared one story. I know a person who was trying to make their bed, and then by just lifting the corner of their mattress, they had a medical emergency begin through the tearing of their muscles and the lining of their stomach. They had this massive hernias that they got as a result of it, and then had to go into surgery. That's from lifting the corner of a bed. This was a person in their 80s, right? Of their mattress. They're just trying to make their bed. So we're talking about people who come to terms with the idea that my body is just fragile for whatever reason. If I have osteoporosis or whatever is going on, or just reaching that place where I'm kind of a failure to flourish. I'm just not flourishing any longer. And if you sit down with that person and say, this is what this type of medical intervention will do to your body. I'm going to be honest, Melanie, I wish I could unlearn some of the things I've read, in the sense of I have read cases of where they applied CPR to people and some of the horrible things that have happened to their bodies as a result to these people who are in the last moments of their lives, read in detailed accounts from doctors. And it made me wish I could unlearn that. Because now I think in terms of the people that I love, and I think, I want you to live for as long as you can. The people that I love, I want you to live as long as you can. But there are people in my life that I look at and I think, I don't want someone to do that to you. Not now. Even if we were able to get you. And I said the success rate, you measure it in different terms. Can I get somebody from a cardiac arrest to the hospital alive? Can I get them into treatment in the hospital to discharge alive? Will there be effects after the discharge that they're going to be living with for the rest of their lives? And when you add all of that together, the level of success, so to speak, becomes shockingly low. And compared to the violence of the level of treatment, it makes sense to have a conversation with a doctor you trust. So sit down with a doctor that you trust and say, you know my health better than anyone else in the world. What do you think about DNRs? What do you think about attempts to resuscitate me at this point in my life? What would be the cost on my life? What would be the chances of success? What would be the probability that I would walk out able to enjoy my life as I did prior to all of this? A doctor or medical professional that you trust will give you honest answers. And if you have a doctor or medical professional that you don't trust overseeing your care, go find one that you do.
Now, you've talked about like older people, but I think all Christians should think about this. So how should they think about this in a way where we can actually get it done? I think it's one of the probably lowest priorities that people have, sign a DNR or don't sign a DNR. And you talked about making your wishes known. If after listening to this podcast, no matter your age, is it something you should tell a loved one? Well, hey, I listened to this and I don't want to have a DNR, or I don't have one and I should get one. How should we think through this issue?
I think one of the things, there was a couple of books that I've read that I thought were great, in the sense of one of them is by a doctor named Farr Curlin and a professor of philosophy named Christopher Tollefson, called The Way of Medicine. Another one is by a guy by the name of Carter O. Sneed, out of Notre Dame, where he talks and both of these, his calls What It Means to Be Human, The Case for the Body in Public Bioethics. And even the Evangelium Vitae by Pope John Paul II, all of these people talk about the idea of properly used medicine takes into account the human being as a whole, right? That we're embodied. We're not bodies, we're embodied beings. And so it takes into account the human being as a whole and the circumstances. And so medical directives are things that all of us should consider and think about and talk to our families about. We should think before we get into those situations, these are the places, these are the things that I would like done, these are the things that I would not like done. We should become educated as best we can about what different procedures would look like under different circumstances. But another thing that's important, and I think every one of those people that I mentioned, Carter O. Sneed, Christopher Tollefson, Farr Curlin, and Pope John Paul II when he was alive, all of them would say that your medical directives are in flux. We shouldn't look at them as permanent things. For if I give a medical directive right now, and let's say I change my mind, because right now I would not sign a DNR for me or for my wife. There are other people that I would probably say you should have a serious conversation with your doctor and make certain decisions, but I wouldn't even consider them for my wife and I at this point, because the cost would be worth the payout of the possibility of living longer at this age, a stage of our lives, at a stage of health that we're in. Because it's not age necessarily, it's the stage of health. There are very, robustly healthy older people that should say, look, my body can handle it. There are other people that are dealing with things. They would come to terms saying my body probably can't handle this. Each person must be dealt with as an individual. Each person must make their decisions, and they must go into a medical relationship where they understand, and the medical professionals also understand, that these directives can change. That I can make these directives now and say, this is what I want right now, but then I can make changes to it later if I wish to. It could be that I sign a DNR, but I go into the hospital and I am feeling good about my chances of surviving whatever got me in. And when I get to the hospital, I say, look, I have a DNR right now on my medical records. I would like that lifted and have that. I want to talk to somebody right now. I want resuscitation right now. I thought about it 5 months ago, 10 years ago, whenever I was thinking about all of this, I thought that I wanted one thing, but at this moment I want another, and start to make those medical directives, not as a sense that I'm making permanent plans right now, but to see it as I'm trying to figure out what the best path forward through this medical relationship that I'm going to have moving towards my natural death will be. And I want to understand and stay in constant communication with the people around me, because I need to understand that they shouldn't be seen as permanent decisions every time you make them, but that you can make episodic decisions, that you can see things coming and you can say, look, right now I'm healthy. I don't need a DNR. I feel healthy. I feel like I can handle it. I feel like I'm capable of dealing with it. Or even though I think I have a very low probability of surviving, I feel like I want it. I want to have a chance to come out of this, even if that means I have to go through what I have to go through to get there. But having those conversations and looking forward and understanding, fear of death should never drive us. It just shouldn't. Not as a Christians. We shouldn't be driven by a fear of death, but nor should we be driven by a desire to die. We should look at what's coming. And it's necessary, because medical ability to keep us alive, to prolong our life, is just going to advance as the years go on. And so we have to be both aware of what that means, what that requires of us, and to be confident in our autonomy to be able to make decisions for ourselves and to talk to the people around us and to make those decisions made known. So that is one thing I wanted to make very clear. And that's what every author that I've read about this, as far as the ethics of it goes, if you have a DNR, but you're heading towards a medical situation, lift it if you want to. It's not a permanent thing. If you put a DNR on file, you can go into everybody around you and say, I want the DNR lifted. All you have to do is sign a piece of paper, have a witness sign it. So you just need a witness. You need somebody to witness that you signed a piece of paper saying that you want the DNR lifted in case something happens as you go into the hospital, or you make those views known to the medical professionals in the hospital. We just can't look at medical care as an all or nothing, all I make this decision and it's permanent kind of thing. Everything must be understood in the circumstances and in the context with which these things are happening, to the person to whom it's happening, and that everybody is in flux making decisions about what's best for the health and flourishing of the patient. Either the patient makes it for themselves, or their medical proxies or medical surrogates who know them well are going to help them in that situation when they can't express them for themselves, or they've stayed in constant communication with their doctors saying, I want to have open and honest conversations about this, because death is going to come to us all. And so let's face it, like people who have hope that there's more beyond it, and be honest in our conversations with the people around us about what it means for us and for them at the end of our lives.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot to think about today, Jay. And so I'm going to end our conversation here, but I do have a fun question for you, because that's kind of a heavy topic.
Yes, so
we're heading into the summer soon. And what would you prefer, going to the ocean and swimming in the ocean, or going lakeside and swimming in a lake?
Oh, I love the ocean. Particularly, I love the Gulf of Mexico. There's a place that we go every year, and I wake up early in the morning. I go down, I set chairs up at like 5:30 in the morning to beat the rush of people that are fighting for space on the beach. And then I just sit there for about an hour and a half by myself and pray, and the noise, the smell, I am an ocean guy. That is my place of peace. So yes, after working on this and thinking about the things and reading about the things I've read about, I am looking forward to the next opportunity to just be at that moment of peace with God. And this, because there's a lovely moment for me at the ocean where I feel small, he feels big, and I know he's got it.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
It was great to be a guest again.
You've been listening to episode 441 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Jay Watts, founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc. We have been talking about his online exclusive feature article for the journal, which you can read for free. His article is called Exploring DNR Decisions with Hope. Please head on over to equip.org to read his article. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.